Welcome to the podcast of Motorweek, television's original automotive magazine. Here's your Motorweek podcast host, John Davis.
And this is Motorweek podcast number 51. I am John Davis, and joining me today are our road test producer and two-wheeling reporter, Brian Robinson.
Hello.
And also our associate producer, Ben Davis.
Rounding up the rear.
And we're going to be basically looking at some muscle, a Mini Cooper with something different, a midsize wagon. And let's get right into the vehicles we're going to talk about on this podcast. And we're going to start with one of the highest performance cars that we've gotten into our shop in the last couple of years. SLP Engineering is known for their work on various GM and other brand pony and coupes over the last, I guess, 20-some years. ZL1, Camaro ZL1 is their latest creation. And from all accounts, it's a pretty good one. Brian, you want to start?
Yeah, it was awesome. When you tell people, you know, 750 horsepower Camaro, you know, everyone's like, whoa, that thing must have been crazy insane. And it was fast, definitely fast. But it was amazingly well put together and just a pleasure to drive street car.
You know, SLP, which stands for Street Legal Performance, has been doing Firebirds and other GM F-body type of vehicles for a long, long time. They're a tuner, an aftermarket tuner, but they do very, very good work, and they've been sanctioned by GM for their work, and actually most of the cars are sold through, I guess, GM dealers. So they've got a good pedigree.
Yeah, and basically they take an SS Camaro, like I say, totally rework the engine, get 750 horsepower out of it, and do a lot of suspension mods, and it was a blast.
Now, we had the car at Roebling Road, our two-mile road course, back in January. And, Brian, you spent a lot of time driving the car. Give me an idea from first use of the throttle off the line to around the track, what it was like to drive on a road course.
Yeah, doing straight line, you know, 0-60 testing in quarter miles, it's extremely hard to hook up. Obviously, it had street tires on it, and 750 horsepower usually don't work that well together. So once you could get it rolling, then you could feed in some throttle, but you kind of had to launch it at idle. And once we got on the track and started putting in laps, I mean, it was awesome. It stays really flat, and it really hooked up coming off corners. You know, it wasn't constantly sideways and all crazy. It was really nailed down.
You know, 0-60 in what, the low fours, as I recall?
I think it was low threes.
Low threes, sorry.
Yeah.
And that basically was with your hookup problem. I mean, it was the car itself. We did basically drive it in some horrific conditions. It was not only cold, but extremely windy. But the car seemed to come through just fine. Ben, this is not the first ZL1 at Chevrolet, and frankly, it's not the only ZL1 at Chevrolet. Give us a little background.
I think it's really cool that ZL1 is just popping up all over the place. I mean, SLP, they have this Camaro, and Chevrolet's there. They have plans to bring back their ZL1 Camaro.
They showed it at the Chicago Auto Show.
Yeah. I mean, even though when it first came out in 69 as a ZL1 Camaro, it was a few years before I was born, but I spent most of my childhood reading about it and fantasizing about maybe seeing one in person at one point or another. Basically, back then, the LS1 was a all-aluminum. It was an aluminum block 427 with aluminum heads. It was $163.25 option back in 69.
Oh, my goodness. Isn't that amazing?
And it was it was really underrated at 330-some horsepower. They thought it was more around 500 back then.
Now, the SLP car is going to be limited production, right?
That's what I hear. I hear they're, the SLP car, they're putting out 69 units.
Like the original.
In honor of the 69.
It is a 427, just like the original, too.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to another car that I think captivated a lot more attention in this case than we probably expected, and that's the redone Dodge Charger. Frankly, when they said that they were going to basically do what we would normally call a freshening of Dodge's big sort of pseudo police cruiser, everybody was sort of like, okay, that means a little bit new sheet metal and we'll get on with it. But like all the rest of the products that Dodge and Chrysler has redone in the last 6 months, much, much nicer interior. The sheet metal on the outside has a lot more of the flavor of the, 68 through early 70s
Chargers. Yeah, especially the rear taillights. They kind of took that look from the rear taillights.
Straight out of the 69s and 70s, yeah, the rears.
And also the hood scoops and body side scooping.
Yeah.
You know, basically a stamping into the body panels. Really a much tougher looking car. But on the inside, far more civilized.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. It's definitely a big step up inside. And it's got a huge nav screen now right in the side of the dash.
It's a really nice nav screen.
And it's a Garmin nav screen.
Garmin-based, so much easier to use than the previous Chrysler ones. Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's wild to see such a big car with such bold and sharp lines on it.
Often they don't look good that way.
And it takes you back. I can't remember the last time I've seen one with that much character to it before. Because you usually see big – I mean, even the Taurus
is kind of smooth and
sleek, and Chevy offerings as well. It's pretty wild. It's – you know, I know other people grew up during all the 70s, 60s, and 70s with full-size cars with a lot of personality and flair. But it's kind of something that's gotten washed away through the 90s and –
Yeah, we had the V6 for a test, so I can't wait to get into the RT
and the SRT8. Yeah, we chose the V6 because it was really our first chance to drive the new Chrysler Pentastar V6 in a rear drive platform. It was pretty impressive. I mean, basically, it's got almost as much output as a V8 in many cases.
Yeah, I would agree. It's not the torquiest of engines off the line, but once you get it wound up, it's pretty strong.
Moving on, Mini Cooper Countryman. I was particularly interested in this. This is, of course, Mini Cooper's first, if you please, crossover utility. It does come with available four-wheel drive, which is the first Mini Cooper to ever offer that, or all-wheel drive, as the case may be. A bit stouter. It's a different frame than the Coopers up to now, these new-gen Coopers. Yeah, I don't know. When I first saw the vehicle, I was a little put off by the styling, because to me it took basically a very attractive, neat package and tried to make it look like it was inflated with a little bit of helium. But as we got the car in here at work and I had to drive it, it didn't bother me. The interior is definitely more roomy. It only seats four standard, but you can get a fifth seat, a bench in the back if you want. Much higher cargo capacity. And we heard today that it's doing a real number on the Clubman, the wagon version. Basically, people are opting for the Countryman instead. Two powertrains, but if you want the all-wheel drive, you've got to upgrade to the turbocharged engine. The standard engine probably isn't quite enough for most people. Even with the turbocharged engine, I thought performance was adequate. I certainly wouldn't call it that fast, although 7 seconds 0-60 is not bad. My overall impression, if you are in the market for a Mini, you'll probably like it. But Brian, what do you think about the Countryman and compared to, say, a lot? There's a lot of other smaller SUVs out there.
Sure, and that's the problem with the Countryman. I mean, I love driving it. It's fun. I couldn't believe how much room's in there in the rear seat now. But just the price, I mean, mid-30s by the time you get all-wheel drive.
And that
turbo.
Didn't have leather on it.
Yeah, and there's so many crossovers now that you can get for way less than that. So, you know, kind of like you said, if you're a Mini guy and you just need more room, then that's for you, but I can't see anybody else being attracted to it.
I agree. At that price, you're even carrying over into some base model premium wagons like an A4 or a 3 Series BMW wagon. So it kind of blurs the line between crossover and wagon.
Yeah, so they're selling well now. I guess it remains to be seen how well they'll do down the line. But it is another notch in their belt, adding they've now expanded to really almost a full car line. I hope there's not a pickup truck in the future.
I was just going to say, I hope there was one. That would be cool.
Well, I could. It probably would have a pretty good niche.
Big travel law like they used to have back in the day.
And so far, you know, they have basically copied their heritage. They've been keeping up with it.
I believe they've still had some quality issues. I know the recent J.D. Power thing came out, and they were
last.
I don't think they were dead last, but they were next to last. Yeah. Or maybe they were definitely
at the bottom. Well, it was Land Rover and
Jeep was down there pretty far.
Yeah, and I think many
customer complaints. Yeah.
Moving on to a more traditional station wagon, the Acura TSX Sport Wagon. Okay, set the stage here. Compact midsize wagon, front-wheel drive, basically the four-cylinder only, where the TSX sedan, you can get a four or a six. Is it really a sport wagon, Ben?
Contrary to what a lot may think from the word sport, it is a sport wagon, I would call it. It does handle great, and it is a blast to drive, but, you know, it might be hard to call something sporty offering only a five-speed automatic transmission, no manual trans.
And just the four-cylinder, too, not just the six.
I might even let that slide if it came with some kind of a manual trans.
Or at least if they basically put a more modern transmission in, at least a six-speed or something. On the other hand, I've been in the market for a station wagon, and if it had...
Wait a minute. You're in the market for a station wagon?
Absolutely.
I didn't realize my
spouse is in the market for a station wagon. But, you know, if it had all-wheel drive to it, I'd be seriously looking at it because it drives great. It's certainly the right size. And you forget that there's a box in the back when you're driving it. It is put together very well. But I don't know. The four-cylinder, if you load it up, I'm not sure how that would be.
It was comfortable. I spent some time in it. I think if anybody, Acura really nails the mix of luxury and technology. I mean, it feels very luxurious and there's also a very high-tech feel to it. But, you know, I'm not sure that despite all these wagons that are coming out, mm-hmm. I mean, we've got CTSV wagon and all that stuff, I'm not sure anybody's buying them. I don't know.
It does seem to be a small market. I mean, the only wagon out right now that really is in high demand is the Subaru Outback.
Yeah.
But they have certain advantages. One of the reasons Cheryl, my spouse, is interested in it, she likes it because you don't climb up as high as you do in a crossover utility. She's done that for years, and she likes that. And also for ease of loading, you have a much lower load floor. Wagons, let's face it, Americans have moved past that. They've gone to minivans and they've gone to crossovers and so forth. So it's a small market.
And this is basically the European Accord
correct.
Wagon, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the TSX is basically the European Accord, which is to say it's a little smaller than the American Accord. Okay, let's turn now to our lightning round, where our Motor Week panelists have the opportunity to share their opinions on the topics making a difference. We'll have 2 minutes, and when the 2 minutes is up, we will hear from Michelle back there with the bell. And if we ignore her, she'll throw the bell at us, and you'll hear it again. Okay, here we go. 2011 looked to be a comeback year for the auto industry, but production of everything from microchips to paint chips has been halted in many places in the Far East due to the earthquake in Japan. Does this global sourcing expose a weakness in how vehicles are assembled not only in North America but elsewhere? You know, one of the things that are... A lot of the cars have something like 40,000 parts, you know, I guess if you count every washer and bolt. And there's huge pressure on companies to not only have the best technology, but to keep prices low. And that has driven a lot of parts manufacturing offshore. And I guess this is a once-in-a-lifetime event. So I'm not really sure this is shows a fault in the system.
Yeah, you can't plan for natural disasters. I mean, that's another problem, too, is just inventory. Everyone, I think the Japanese market really stuttered that don't have any parts until you need them kind of thing.
Just-in-time manufacturing.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not like they've got tons of parts sitting around that they can, you know, start slapping together. You know,
now, the average plant only has a few hours in many cases, and at most a couple of days worth of parts of a particular parts. But it's
amazing how one of those parts missing can stop the line dead, too.
Absolutely. It can be something relatively minor, but if you're building hundreds or even thousands of cars in a short period of time, a few days or a week, you know, you can't go back and just fix them all very easily.
Yeah, in the larger picture, I mean, there's a lot worse things going on in Japan right now than the fact that we're not getting cars right now.
And I think it will take care of itself. You know, as people are listening to this podcast, a lot of the Japanese plants, both parts and otherwise, are coming back on stream, and manufacturers are finding other sources for some of those parts in areas of the world that have been impacted. So if this is the worst thing we have, which is a delay in car production because of the Japanese disaster, it's not very meaningful. Okay. Now on to our Motor Week mailbag, and this one comes from Ken from my home state of North Carolina. I'm sorry Pat Goss is not here, Ken, because he has the answer to this, but we'll try and paraphrase him. He says, I'm wondering how valid are the manufacturer's recommended octane requirements for gasoline. If premium fuel is recommended, can you run 87 octane regular without an issue? Is it simply a suggestion for optimum horsepower and performance? Is it really required? I'd like to save a little money. Okay. If Pat was here, he'd basically say that primarily you have to look at the owner's manual. If a vehicle says that premium fuel is recommended, but you can run it on regular, then you're fine because the engine computer in the vehicle will take care of adjusting the engine. You will lose some peak horsepower and you will lose a little peak fuel economy, but you'll be fine. And studies have shown that the amount you're losing in fuel economy is less than you would cost you to upgrade and pay more for premium fuel. However, if the owner's manual says premium is required, you should not use regular. You run the risk of damaging the engine and, of course, voiding your warranty. Pat also says that if a car says use regular, there usually is virtually nothing to gain from using premium. And in fact, long-term use of premium in a car that requires regular can do some damage. Would you guys like to add anything to that?
The only thing I could add is I have the recommended premium in my car, and I virtually never put premium in it. And I've kept track, and there is a slight, literally half a percent or half a mile per gallon, not half percent. It's like a half mile per gallon less, and I've never had any problems
with
it.
Is that Celica?
Yeah, the Toyota.
Wow.
Yeah, generally speaking, most cars that are required, that should say recommend premium, it's a marketing situation. Owners will think those cars are higher-end cars because the engine computers now can pretty much compensate for anything. So that brings to an end to our Motor Week podcast number 51. I'd like to give special thanks to our audio engineer, David Wainwright, our podcast creator, Bob Mixter, and our producer, Michelle Parker, the lady with the bell. Thanks to all of you for listening to our Motor Week podcast, and be sure to watch Motor Week on your local public television station. I'm John Davis. We'll see you here on Motor Week.
You have been listening to the podcast of Motor Week, television's original automotive magazine. For additional information on podcasts, videos, and showtimes, visit our website at motorweek.org. And watch Motor Week, television's longest-running automotive magazine series, each week on your local PBS station.